This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? Today we're talking all about critical steps with three guys that have just wrote a book on critical steps. Let's get into the intro and I'll tell you some more about it.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviors.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding safety. Crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by Risk Fluent.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is the YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. We're here to change the perception of health and safety. So hit subscribe and like and all that stuff, right? Today we're talking to three gentlemen, three lovely guys, three American guys. I don't know why I need to point that out. Three lovely American guys. The American is not relative to the point. Anyway, they are called Jim Arenas, Ron Farris, and Tony Mishara, and they've just teamed up to write a book, and today we're going to talk about that book. I read a couple of chapters, they sent me a couple of chapters to have a skim through before we had a chat, and I had some questions, and we were talking about the book, and why they wrote it, and so on and so forth. So it's a really good chat, hope you enjoy it. Before we get into it though, let's just have a quick shout out to Paradigm Human Performance, our sponsors for Rebranding Safety YouTube channel and podcast. Paradigm Human Performance are human organizational performance experts. If you know them, you know them. They're a great team of people, all a lovely bunch of people. They run a webinar every other week on a Thursday at 2 p.m. called the Learning Organization Webinar. They've built a fantastic little community of which I'm happy to be part of. And Teresa is a lovely lady doing some amazing work. And that company are what they say they are. They are full of human factors, human organizational performance experts. They do a great job of working and partnering with customers and companies, help them take that next step in their evolutionary journey of risk management. So if you're looking for a company to help you onboard a load of those principles of HARP and how to get your humans and your organizations working better together, then Paradigm is the consultant for you. So go check out all their details in the description below, email, phone number, website. And whilst you're on the website, sign up to the Learning Organization webinar if you haven't already. So a couple more shout outs. Don't forget to check out Rebranding Safety and Project Millennium down below. Rebranding Safety now got a consultancy. So there's loads of stuff that we can help you at Risk Fluent. Rebranding Safety's got social media influencing solutions. If you're trying to sell or advertise within the safety community and risk community, check out below. And then Project Millennium is a great place for your professional development, the only mastermind for health and safety and risk professionals. Without further ado, let's jump into the amazing chat with Ron Farris, Jim Arenas, and Tony Mishara. Let's go. Right, gents, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for coming on. Do you want to
be here?
Thank you very much. Good. I'm glad to have you. We're not going to talk about guns. We just spoke about guns for the hour. No wonder I do think that would be a really interesting podcast. You'll need to have a couple of beers. We're like five British people, five American people, have a couple of beers. It'd be the most amicable and nice debate that we've ever had.
You could talk about human and organizational performance with a focus on you know, gun safety.
I think that's happening. I think that's what you know, I can't remember his surname. It's a guy called Bill. There's a safety malcontent. He's a quite on LinkedIn. He's quite popular. I can't remember his surname, but me and him got into a little bit of a robust conversation on WhatsApp group that we're in, because after the horrific event on the film studio with Alec Baldwin, where he unfortunately shot a pistol. And I remember just being shocked that they have real pistols. And I'm like, it's 2021. Why are we still using real pistols on a film set? Surely we've been to the moon. Elon Musk is making a rocket that can go to space and come back and land. And we haven't decided to invent a gun that it looks good on film, but is not a real gun. And then Bill was just like, as long as you've got gun safety and you know how to use it, I've trained Marines. And I was just like,
Yeah, I forgot I was talking to Americans. I've lost this argument already. Right. Anyway, gents, do you want to introduce yourself? Kind of just go around the room, tell us who you are and what you do, and then we'll get into your book.
Well, I'm Tony Machera, and I live in Atlanta, Georgia, and I've been working in human and organizational performance probably for the last, well, it's easier to say since when. I'd say 1985 when I joined the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations. But my background is nuclear operations. I was a simulator instructor at a nuclear power station. And before that, I spent 7 years active duty in the nuclear submarine force, qualified as a engineer of naval nuclear propulsion systems. So that's my technical background, but I'm also a certified performance technologist by the International Society of Performance Improvement. And I'm basically a consultant. I've been a consultant since 2007.
Awesome. Who wants to go next?
Sure. Go ahead, Ron. Ron Ferris. I've been a human organizational performance consultant probably for 6 years now. I work with Hope Consulting, where I'm a business partner, and then I have a video-based training company where we develop high reliability organization and human performance video-based training. And what I mean by video, it's real life video of workers in the field. And we talk about what we describe in the HOP world. I spent 8 years in the nuclear Navy in the 1980s, basically. So I was aboard the USS Nimitz, and I was a training instructor for my last 3 years in Idaho, which is where I ended up. So I'm Idaho Falls, Idaho. I worked at Argonne National Laboratory as a reactor operator on a fast sodium reactor, similar to what Bill Gates is going to build over here in Wyoming, the TerraPower project. I also worked on the TerraPower project as a research scientist in human factors. So my last 8 years at Idaho National Lab, I was a research scientist, and I had been a safety engineer for a few years as well. I've got a couple of certificates, one of them human performance and one emergency management. But my background is operations and maintenance and management. So I've leveraged that information and tried to bring those experiences of both turning a wrench or flipping a switch to this book and some of our, even in some of our personal experiences.
Awesome.
I'm Jim Marinas. My background, like these two, is nuclear Navy. I rode submarines. Went from there into nuclear weapons material production, and then spent stints in research operations leadership. Some work doing consulting at Los Alamos in nuclear weapons design. A little bit of work with some of the other national labs in human and organizational performance. And I currently consult, have been doing that since 2015 in human and organizational performance. My background is also mechanical. Have a good amount of experience working in nuclear plants, research environments, and do them all. Good bit of my own personal mechanic work still. So
I'm going to summarize that you all know a little bit about human organizational performance, nuclear power, just a bit, just a little.
Enough to be dangerous.
Yeah. I'm kind of blown away, if I'm honest. Like I'd hate if I was introducing myself next. I'm not, because it's my podcast, but if I had to go after you three, I'd be like, oh shit, I'm just gonna I did nothing as a teenager, just played on skateboard a little bit, drank too much, and then I ended up in plastics manufacturing, and that's it really.
Well, we have a few years on you, James.
Yeah. Hopefully, by the time I get a bit older, I can craft such a beautiful introduction like that. Fair play to you all, gents, I'm impressed already. That was an impressive introduction. Right. So the book. One of you actually just give us an introduction to the book first, because I know it's not out yet. I know a lot of people that know you guys or are in that community kind of know it's coming out. And some people might have got the first introduction and the free chapters on the website. But if one of you could just maybe give us an introduction to the book first, and then we'll move into kind of getting a bit deeper, if that makes sense.
You guys mind if I jump on that one?
Go ahead, Tony.
You should.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, basically, Critical Steps came to my attention back in the mid-1990s when we at the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, we were looking at human performance for the commercial nuclear industry. And one of the first tools that we came up with was called self-checking. And we used the mnemonic called Stop, Think, Act, Review, or STAR. And the question came up, well, when do you use STAR? And the idea was, well, you want to make sure you're paying attention, you're touching the right thing, you're going to do the right thing, and you verify the right thing when the risk is high. And at that time, we didn't necessarily call those situations critical steps or those human actions critical steps, but we had that idea. And then in late 1990s, 97, 98, we wrote the book called Excellence in Human Performance with the aid of Dr. James Reason. He was our consultant for that. And we started using the phrase critical steps, which we actually borrowed from the Department of Energy's terminology for important or risk-based type steps. They called them hazardous steps. And Pantex, which is the panhandle of Texas, the Department of Energy facility there, what would you say, Jim? They assembled and disassembled nuclear weapons, nuclear devices.
That's right.
And so they had these steps called hazardous steps and critical steps. And hazardous steps was considered the more serious, but they had a lot of words in their definitions that had a lot of there was no real clear and crisp definition of what was hazardous, what was critical. And so when we wrote the Excellence in Human Performance booklet, we started using that concept critical step because it had a greater sense of dread associated with a human action, and it better go right the first time or else you're going to suffer serious consequences. But along with that, let me go ahead and define it. You know, critical steps is that human action that will trigger immediate, irreversible, and intolerable harm to an asset if that action or a preceding action had been done improperly. And that last phrase, preceding action, refers to what we call risk important actions. And I'm going to let Ron talk about that a little bit later. But that's the idea of a critical step. And we realized this is something that the industry can benefit from. And so I've been using the concept and training clients on the concept since then. Back in 2018, I had the opportunity to publish my first book, which was Risk-Based Thinking. And there was a chapter in there on critical steps. As a chapter, I looked at it and I thought, there's a lot more to this concept that could be conveyed to the general public about how to manage, how to identify, how to manage and exercise positive control over these high risk activities. And then what do you do if you do make a mistake at a critical step? And so fundamentally the book is about those three things. One, identify a critical step. Number two, exercise positive control of a critical step. But if you lose control, you have to fail. If you can, fail safely. And the fourth objective of the book is to align the organization to support those first three objectives. And so that's what the book is really all about: identify, control, and then fail safely.
Awesome. So how did you three gents come together and write the book? Like, how did that happen? Was it natural, or was it just like, you know, over a beer or talking about humans or something?
Yeah, so luckily Tony and I happened to be working together, and we were working at one of our client facilities, and we were talking, and he had seen some work that I was doing that was very similar to what he was very interested in doing with his book. And he told me about writing the book. And next thing I know, he gave me the great opportunity to be a co-author in the book. And I jumped on it, of course, because risk-based thinking is literally one of my desktop books. And I put the spiral. So I always refer to it. It's got a ton written in it. And it's my favorite book because Tony's a very good writer. And
thank
the
you.
Critical steps chapter, I literally just painted it yellow because the whole chapter is that important. But it was a great opportunity. And then I'll let Jim talk about how he came on board.
Tony and I go way back. We crossed paths really in the night at Institute of Nuclear Power Operations. We didn't work together there, but we were there during the same period. And as soon as I saw one of the precursor programs to human performance at IMPO, it piqued my interest. And it was HPES, Tony, if you remember that.
Right.
Human Performance Enhancement. And I just resonated with the messaging in that document. Then I had the opportunity to review Tony's first book, provided some feedback on that. Had been working in resilience, and I got a call actually from Tony when I was up in Alaska working with ConocoPhillips, asking if I'd be interested in writing the book with him, and I jumped at the opportunity. I felt that was a real honor, and I wanted to contribute the aspects of resilience that I had been working both with ConocoPhillips and some of the Department of Energy labs. So got an offer and jumped at it.
Let me add to that, James. I wrote Risk-Based Thinking by myself, and I realized there were some gaps in that book, and I didn't want to have gaps in this book. And so I realized I need somebody looking over my shoulder or asking the hard questions. And we had some hard questions. We had some in-depth conversations about various topics, and we'll explore that a little bit later. But it opened my eyes to things I hadn't thought of, like failing safely. That was something I had not thought of. Conversations is an important aspect of this. Adaptive capacity. Those were a couple of topics I had not previously considered. So that was a big plus for this book.
Yeah, nice. I like that. I call them robust conversations, Tony.
We do, actually. We use that term in the book, James, specifically.
Yeah, they were robust, but I'd say put the accent on the bust. We had some long Zoom meetings. I think some of them lasted more than 2 hours.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we had very one nice. That went over four.
Oh, okay. That's right.
Very robust conversation then. Why that concept of critical step? I mean, there is so much in human organizational performance in there. And Jim, you mentioned kind of resilience as well, which you like, I suppose you could kind of class as a separate kind of philosophy or theory of they kind of overlap. There's so much out there now. Why did you kind of go, we need to at least focus on critical step, or at least use that to structure our conversation? Why was it that one thing that you thought you needed to write a book about?
Well, let me jump on that. It's one of those things that I emphasized even when I was working at the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, or IMPO, even in the early 1990s, and I felt like the industry could benefit from it. In fact, most everywhere you went in the nuclear industry, they really believed in that. Content validity. It was just a valid concept from an operator's perspective. But we had not put flesh on those bones. They knew the concept, but people didn't quite understand how to define it and how to use that definition and how to discipline themselves to identify where is the real risk in operations. And so one of the things that I realized in the safety arena, the personnel or industrial or occupational safety arena, is there's a lot of emphasis on hazards, identifying hazards. And then in the early human performance days, there's still is today a lot of emphasis on error avoidance, avoiding error. Basically we just flipped the page or flipped the chart here and said, okay, the focus is really on assets. When assets are broken or harmed or injured or damaged in some way, that's what causes events or accidents or incidents at an organization. So let's focus on assets. And then also get away from trying to avoid every mistake. Let's focus on those mistakes that have the greatest risk, or let's talk about losses of control, not so much error, but losses of control of the work as you're trying to add value. So that's the nitty gritty of why I thought this was an important concept.
Yeah. So I've just add on a little bit there is that, you know, in the world of work, so often, and I go to various clients, there seems to be this hyperventilation going on related to risk and risk management. And how do you manage all that? And the problem I've seen with organizations that have adopted some hot HOP philosophies, tools, techniques, is that if everything's important, things are equally unimportant. And that's a problem, right? So how do we narrow that focus? And that's one of the things we bring in this book is that idea of how to draw out the discrete actions that you absolutely must have go right, or validate that certain things are set you up to have success at that moment in time. Yeah. I was at a nuclear power plant, and I was doing some research there, and we pulled all the folks together, and I was looking at how to address human performance with technology, and then goes to mind what this industry had done. And there was, every time they had an accident or an event, they piled more tools on top of the tools they were already using, to the point that the tools were becoming the error precursors of their next event because they were no longer focused on task. And when we pulled all the human performance people together from the various organizations, and I told them what I was there to do, and they said, I hope the heck that you're not here to give us more of this crap. And they held up all their nuclear jewelry, we call it, which was all their human performance tools they had to carry around on their lanyard and then break those out to do their work. And what we try to do in this book is narrow that focus of when is those tools and which tools are appropriate, not and when. And if you say you got to use your human performance all the time, it loses its value. Mm-hmm. And we're watering down that most important aspect of the task. And I think that's one of the things we really do a good job bringing out in this book is how to help those folks who've struggled with that aspect. They've adopted this, they've been doing it for years, and they don't know what to do next. I think this book answers that question.
I think you kind of go on, Jim. Sorry, mate.
Well, go ahead. If you wanted to follow up on something Ron said there, I was just going to add another perspective, but that can wait a sec.
I was just going to carry on. I was just thinking I might end up going us down a rabbit hole here, which is just dangerous. But I think you stumbled on something really interesting on that, Ron, and that this kind of addiction that we have at the moment for like a one standardized approach to absolutely everything. So when we think about managing our risks, and then somebody goes, what about HOP? We go, yeah, it's HOP. What for? Everything, for everything. Let's do it for everything. and what we don't realize is that, and I've seen it as well. So in the UK, we kind of have different terminologies, but really kind of looking at the same stuff. So we've got HOP that we kind of look at for kind of, which is similar to you guys, what you call it. But then we also have like a bit of a bandwagon at the moment for resilience or resilience engineering. And approaches to that, which are kind of very similar, or at least complementary. But it's interesting, just to kind of follow up on your example, Ron, is that I've seen a lot of conversations where people go, we need to be resilient. As an organization, we need to be totally resilient. And I'm like, well, hang on a minute. There's a trade-off. When you're resilient, there's a trade-off, and that trade-off is efficiency, because we've become so efficient for so long, not resilient. So it's not one or the other. It's working out to your point, which I think is where we'll end up getting to, is identifying what are those things that can really hurt us as a person or as a company or whatever, as a brand. That's where we're resilient. And then what are the stuff that's not really that much higher risk, or maybe the risk is to, you know, production. That's where we might be efficient.
Right.
So it's kind of like lean and resilience together, not one or the other. So I think, Ron, you've hit the nail on the head for me. That's one of our biggest challenges right now.
I was going to actually say something quite similar to what you just pointed out, James. To summarize, what we've done is kind of flipped the conversation, as Tony said, away from what could go wrong to what must go right. And our emphasis is on ensuring success rather than avoiding failure.
Yeah.
Because you actually can't really succeed if you fail, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's not a real difficult concept, but what it does is it helps move the bar away from the linear thinking that has predominated the high-risk industries, which have resulted in approaches like what you described, James. They say, well, we can do this risk evaluation for virtually everything that we handle. We should do that because that makes us better. But it doesn't, because it distracts from the things that you really need to be paying attention to. Mm-hmm. And the other aspect of moving away from linearity into the complex world is the realization that today is almost never just like yesterday. Even if you're handling the same materials, doing the same tasks, things change. And so that's the role of the conversations and getting in there and actually knowing what to pay attention to, knowing what you're going to do to make sure that it goes right, and then knowing what you're monitoring to see if things are in fact changing because of complexity and chaos.
Mm-hmm. It's such an interesting thing. And actually, Jim, I use a line so much now that I stole from you. And I'll be honest with you, don't reference you that much when I tell people that I say, this is a great line.
But that's where it went, you know.
If I write it down somewhere, I definitely would reference it. But no, I, jokes aside, I do genuinely use your typewriter analogy all the time in safety, and that we're getting so kind of that. Don't get me wrong, I'm on the bandwagon with the hop and I love it. Like, and I think that's where we need more of that. But I always use this analogy that you talked about, like, you know, operations is on that tightrope. We've got to create that safety net, but not have those shiny things that distract him. And I remember you saying that in the Paradigm webinar, and I remember everyone just going, no one had anything to say. And I remember just being like, yeah. Wow, that was amazing. And it's so true. That's kind of where we are at the moment, I think, isn't it? Or we have been for a long time.
Let me add to what Jim and Ron have said. Part of the problem that I see with the various and the variety and great books written in safety, quality, productivity, profitability, and so on, organizational factors and so, you know, those particular topics, but most of the vocabulary that's used in those books tend to be academic in nature. They're not written towards people in the front lines. They're not written for the managers of technical organizations. And so what we attempted to do, we're not completely successful in this regard, but for the most part, it's a practical oriented book with the focus on, well, how do you use this, you know, and using words and gloss and terminology that most people use every day in the workplace.
Well,
and by the way, we do have a glossary. Go ahead, Jim.
We pulled examples from the various industries that we have worked in. Because what we've described, you can actually observe right now out there in some segments of industry. And using those as an example, it gave us litmus tests to see if what we were describing was actually helping or just adding confusion. So, you know, we tried to follow the same guidance that we are providing others. Got to pay attention to what matters.
I think you're kind of really hitting on those really important points in that we have, we kind of got so many solutions now. We're kind of a bit drowned in solutions, aren't we? We don't really know how to use them or use them in real working world. And I'm kind of maybe since doing this podcast, like for 3 years now, talking to amazing people like you, then going and buying their book and reading their book. And then like Ron's earlier point, painting it in highlighters and then be like, I can't wait to get to work tomorrow and I'm going to do this. And you kind of get to that point where you're so excited or passionate about doing these new practices, but actually the language, you kind of get to work and you're like, I'm just going to use the very popular one of people are not the problem, the solution. Like that's unbelievably popular. Everybody does it. And like, you kind of read the books and you're like, yeah, people are not the problem. You go to work, hey, gosh, people are not the problem. And they go, okay, what does that look like? And
exactly.
I didn't think of that. So I just read the book and was really excited. And you're right. There's a bit of a lack in whether it's intentional or unintentional. I don't know. And that's probably not a conversation for today, but it's just, there is a real lack in tangible examples. And I found it in my own kind of delivery of trying to implement or educate people on this stuff. And I actually found one of the best examples is a story that I really stumbled across. I remember I went around my father-in-law's house and my sister-in-law was telling a story with her new boyfriend was there. And she was kind of taking a mick out of her new boyfriend because he brought the wrong bottle of wine. So he'd finished his shift. And when he finished the evening shift, you only have like a couple of minutes before the till's shut. And my sister-in-law, Ella, had texted him saying, bring some wine home for dinner, right? So he's now under a lot of pressure, right? So it's like an organizational factor. It's like a tightly coupled system. So I'm like, okay, that's really, and I'm listening to this story and I'm like, tightly coupled system, pressure. Like, and I was like, listening to the story and she's like, and he's like, yeah. So I finished work and then I ran to the fridge because I knew she wanted a Pinot Grigio, which is for those who drinkers, that's a white wine is in the fridge, but there is also a Pinot Noir, which is a red wine. Right? So I'm like, error trap, Pinot. Yeah, so that's an error trap. The fridge. He sees Pinot fridge. He gets it, doesn't even look at the bottle, and he just runs to the till, buys it, goes home. It was Pinot Noir. And I'm like, and she's like, what an idiot, as if he didn't know. And I'm like, latent condition, the red one. And I explained that to people to break down this hop stuff. Like, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But then me going, you know, latent condition is something that's sitting there waiting to happen. They're like, I don't get that. What do you mean? What does that look like in reality? So we're missing those stories that are relatable, those examples that can pick up and go, I know I've got a story for that.
Yeah. And that's an important feature of our book is every chapter starts with a story of a clear example of a critical step and how how the harm occurred. And it usually there's a harm involved or some kind of injury or damage or loss in every one of these examples. But we also emphasize that these concepts can be used at home. You can use these concepts at home.
Because
human performance is human performance.
Yeah. We got a one-year-old. We have hopped the shit out of it. We use it all the time. We're like, right, where's our capacity to fail there? And she challenges me on it all the time. And I'm like, I wish I never told you about this stuff. I love it. I love it. All of it. I think there's an interesting point around, I know we had a pre-chat and I know Ron, you've sent me loads of stuff, which is amazing, around the terminology, getting the terminologies right. And I think this is really interesting point because I was actually on a paradigm human organizational performance training course, and they actually introduced me to the concept of critical step. And I remember the room actually really struggling with it. And it's really interesting because I don't know if you have this in the US, but in the UK, we have HACCP. I don't know if that's a thing. I could tell by your plain face. So we have HACCP, which is Hazard Analysis and Critical Control.
Oh, HACCP, yeah. Uh-huh.
So
HACCP, okay.
Yeah, I recognize it now.
That's what it was. So I came across HACCP when I was in food. As far as I'm aware, it come from the food industry. We kind of took it to a lot of things, and we try and apply it to everything. So we analyze the hazard, and then we put in critical control points. So when they were talking about critical step, it got lost in this critical control point. And they were like, oh yeah, it's kind of like critical control points. And I was like, no, it's not. It's not. Mm-hmm. A critical control point is something that controls it, whereas a critical step is something really different. When they said it's like the point of no return, people started trying to get it. So I think understanding terminology, but also the difference in terminology just from UK to US, you get lost in translation. So I know that's something you guys are keen to kind of address as well in the book. So I don't know if there's any examples or anything you want to kind of mention around that point.
Yeah, well, we do. Go ahead, Ron.
So one of the things that I think is very important, I was working with a client, and I met with the nuclear trainer, the top guy for the nuclear operators for running the reactor. And he was doing his observation and coaching training with me. And we went in, and the observation we were going to do was looking at some folks getting fit tested for their respirators, right? So class full. And we get all done. And I told him, I said, you got a couple of minutes? He said, sure. I said, let's look at this checklist for the respirator. And I said, what does it say here at the top? And it said, the following critical steps. And none of them were critical. Not a single thing on that checklist was a critical step. And I said, what's your definition? He had one. It's very similar to one we use. And I said, so when is it? And the reality was, all those actions were risk important actions. They either created safety or they created danger, or they brought safety by doing it correctly. Mm-hmm. So there was the potential. So none of those things created immediate, irreversible, intolerable harm. And yet they had labeled that. And the problem with that was, is that, like I had said previously, was that it watered it down to the point that the critical step didn't mean anything anymore. Right. So we've highlighted the world. So they've highlighted the entire page with bright highlight, and nobody sees it anymore, right? They're blind to it. And the reality is the use of a respirator only had a critical step the moment you stepped into the area where there was the potential for some sort of uptake, you know, and a respiratory issue. And he recognized it almost immediately when we had this conversation. But that industry, when I worked with them, it was a large corporation. They adopted this idea that we teach in our book, which is risk important actions. And by doing that, they were able to differentiate. I think we're getting a little bit of feedback. Are you guys hearing that?
Jim, I've just unmuted you. Sorry.
Okay.
I've just muted you, Jim, just because you're getting a bit of an echo. So when you go to say something, Jim, remember I've muted you.
So all the point was there is that many industries have adopted the concept of critical steps. One of the things that we bring new to many industries is this idea of a risk important action, which actually create risk important conditions. And I would tell you what's really important there, and we draw it out in the book, is the idea that you're not going to go back and check every one of those actions, but you're going to check the conditions that the actions created. So that's a much smaller subset of things to validate. And one of those might be just simply saying, do we have the check sheet and is it complete? And the answer is yes. Okay, those things are done, check. So we move on. We're not going to go back and do a full respirator check. We're going to do some very unique things. We'll put it on, hold our hands over the end. We'll suck in on it, make sure we got a good seal, hold that. Does it hold? Yep, we're going in, right? So those are the things that we draw out as examples in this book so people can differentiate, and that that labeling of the correct things then drives us to identify the right actions that we need to do to make sure that critical step goes off without a hitch. That's what's important. And I think that's the practical means that we bring. Jim?
Hopefully, no, you're still muted.
You're muted.
The button. Is there anything, hopefully something's coming up on your, there we
there
go.
There it is.
There it is.
What I wanted to add to that was a potentially unexpected benefit to approaching work this way is that you're actually freeing up the expertise of your folks. And the traditional approaches to managing high-risk operations have been impacting the bandwidth of our experts in the field more and more over the years, to the point where some actually would question whether or not you really wanted their expertise, or if you just hired a body that you could paste instructions to. Seriously, I mean, go look at some of your industries you're supporting now, right? What this does is it allows you to unspecify some of the things that are not critical but are important, and allow the expertise of the individuals to be coming into the mix. There are a whole lot of potential benefits to that, as I'm sure you could imagine.
Yeah, there, you had mentioned efficiency earlier, James, and this creates an awareness of those sections or portions of an activity that absolutely are risk important. And so you specify clearly what has to be done. But in other parts of the activity, you leave it up to the workers to decide what needs to be done and what's the best way to do it. So you create efficiencies by knowing where the risk is. But they have to maintain this sense of uneasiness, because there's no such thing as a perfect procedure or perfect training, perfect knowledge, perfect tools. There's this thing called entropy. Things wear out. And so they have to be alert for where there are what I call pathways for energy or pathways for the movement of matter or transmission of information. That's when harm occurs. And so helping them to be aware of those transitions frees up their capacity to do other things without the risk of harm.
I would add up too that one of the things that really helps in just building on what Tony said is that, And you kind of mentioned it, this idea of a latent condition. But when we talk in terms of latent conditions, we also talk in terms of what we call landmines, that kind of a theoretical or abstract idea of what a landmine is in the workplace. And they're really the idea of a hidden critical step. Mm-hmm. So we don't know this thing has the potential. So, for instance, a lot of folks work on their garage doors and they don't realize that there's a landmine waiting to kill them. Right. And that's the spring in that garage door. When it's under stressed and you go to disconnect it, there's been many of people severely damaged and killed due to the spring in a garage door. Nobody even thinks about it, but it could be hydraulic pressure, steam pressure. It could be some kind of load that's, at some height that you didn't know was there. Somebody can knock something off and you didn't put up a barrier and you have an asset underneath. I was working at a facility where folks were working up above and they didn't put a mat down and they had a graded area. Had they dropped a wrench, there was nuclear instrumentation below them and they were in a limited state. So if that instrumentation went out, they had the potential to take the whole plant down.
Yeah.
They had not identified that. And that landmine was sitting there because, like Tony said earlier, there's an asset, which is our focus. What are our assets that we need to protect? And then where is that potential exist? Where's that critical step? And looking for those, one of those things, it frees you up to focus, like Jim said, on the most important things, but it also gives you a mindset for these things Tony was talking about, which is a pathway. And once we start understanding pathways, we start to recognize these landmines more readily, and more importantly, then we can mitigate for them. And that keeps a lot of unexpected things from happening as well.
One, I'll add to that, Ron, the ability to get that focus also from an expertise standpoint. And the things that, James, you've probably heard when resilience is mentioned, the adaptive capacity necessary to manage high-risk operations. If your bandwidth is full because you've specified everything, you have little ability to actually keep your vision broad and to see how things outside your immediate view are actually going. And when you're doing that times the number of people involved, which is rarely just one, because you've got support organizations, you've got the other coordinating organizations and all the members within those, when you're interacting in ways that you're using that bandwidth to say, how are things really going? Then you have the ability to adapt and go back to what Tony was saying. If you do have something that appears to be on the way to failure, you can adapt and fail safely. Mm-hmm. And that's a critical aspect of the approach to managing high-risk operations.
One thing that we ran into, James, you mentioned earlier that there's not a whole lot about written on the practical application of some of these resilience or high reliability concepts. And when we started exploring and doing a deep dive on adaptive capacity, how do you do that? What's the practical ways of creating adaptive capacity in an organization? And there's some great articles and books written along those lines, but not a whole lot on how to do it.
Yeah.
So that just to piggyback on that idea a little bit. So that concept basically is the, and when you hear people talk about the blue line, the black line, you hear a lot of theoreticals, and it's basically this idea of how do you close that gap between the work as imagined and the work as performed, right? You've heard those terms, and there's always a gap. Now, a lot of times we think that gap is a negative when reality, and we call that drift, but in reality, it's a huge positive, and it happens every job. Mm-hmm. The reality is that the workers, we prescribe what's should be occurring. And then the work is dynamic and we've got variable people out there in the workplace, right? So, you know, humans are the greatest source of variability in a dynamic workplace. So given that, they're the ones that are closing that gap and creating safety every single task. And we forget that that's happening. That's why when you say workers are the solution, that's the answer to it, is because they close that gap and they do it for us every single day. Yeah. And they do that because If they didn't, every organization would be shut down because we'd be having events and we'd be out of business. They bring safety. And so what we talk about in the book is very distinct things. And we ended up expanding on that greatly, that adaptive capacity. But it's important for organizations to recognize, you know, how does the engineering group help bring adaptive capacity? How does our frontline supervisors do it? How does management do it? And how do we as individuals improve our adaptive capacity? Mm-hmm. And we talk about those aspects because that piece really is true, but how do you do it? I've never seen anybody write on it. And we did do that with a lot of information.
Well, we also talk about from an organization standpoint, how can you enable that improvement? So not just from an individual perspective, but organizationally, what can you do to ensure that folks have adaptive capacity that they can exercise? And then how can you help build that?
Mm. Yeah. Wow. That was like put 50p in the machine and you three are off. Awesome. What an amazing amount of raff. Wow. That was amazing. Thank you very much.
That's that emergence concept you were talking, you had mentioned earlier.
Conversation. Yeah, that was really good, gents. I loved how you all kind of bounced off each other there. That was really, really nice. An absolute goldmine of data and stories and tips there. And I think there's a couple of things you kind of mentioned there, which I think are really interesting, is releasing some cognitive space for both the person doing the job in the moment, because you've highlighted what is the critical step, what's that really dangerous point of no return. You know, I think that's really powerful, is highlighting that in my brain as a person doing the job, I can now concentrate on the job because I know I'm not anywhere near that critical step right now. But then also the management who are designing the risk mitigation, so to speak, the leaders who are resourcing all of this stuff, is they can now, it's kind of like what we mentioned earlier about the resilience and efficiency kind of trade-off or balance in act that we do. It's kind of going, right, now by identifying where the critical step is, we can build that capacity because that's where we need to focus it. But at this other place, we can now be efficient because it's not the critical step. So I think that was something I took away from it when I got heard of it the first time. And I think you guys have really opened it even more there of just the true potential of highlighting that and how powerful it can be for the workforce.
I know you stole something from Jim, so I'll give you something to steal from me.
Okay.
Jim's such a smart guy. I get to steal stuff from him all the time. But the analogy to me is when everything's important, we look at a task through a keyhole, right? And when we look at that task through a keyhole, like Jim was talking about, we can't see what's happening. We can move our head and we can see a little here and we can see a little there. But in reality is when you do what we're talking about in the book, it actually opens the door.
Yeah.
Right. So now you can see the whole room and it allows you to open up that sphere of thought and the cognition that's going on that's necessary to identify these landmines, to see how the interaction's going and have those conversations around what's important start to happen because we're no longer so prescriptive that we've actually prevented this adaptive capacity. We actually enable it by doing that.
Yeah, let me add to that, James. All three of us were qualified Navy nuclear operators, and while we were active duty in the Navy, either on a carrier, aircraft carrier, or a submarine, there was a lot of emphasis on technical expertise. We were constantly training. We were constantly running scenarios to test and develop our understanding and knowledge of those technical systems to find out not only weaknesses or disclose the weaknesses in what we knew and what we didn't know, but also in the systems, the technical systems, you know, how well were they prepared to operate? And so Admiral Rickover, who was in charge of the nuclear Navy back in those days, he understood that procedures were important, but he knew that they were not always correct. And so his approach to developing adaptive capacity was through our knowledge and skills. And so we spent a lot of time. He knew the operator had to be able to adapt and respond to those unanticipated, unproceduralized situations that we encountered at sea in a very inhospitable environment. So our survival was at risk, you know, if we didn't understand what we were working with.
Yeah.
So that brings another point to that. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I just want to say, not everybody realized that was what Rickover was about. I want to speak to that because there are a lot of folks that characterize Rickover as a real taskmaster and the Navy approach is being very rigid. What Tony just expressed was not that. And I don't think a lot of folks realize that. So it's important to understand Rickover knew that adaptive capacity was requisite.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I would add to that, so when I go out to a lot of organizations, I'll be in the field mentoring staff or observing work. And what I tell everybody, every supervisor, every manager, every leader, every lead on the task, there's a why of work. And this goes to what we're talking about here, this adaptive capacity. And so I was out watching, just to put it in context, I was watching some work. They were taking a pump apart. This pump was having trouble. So they lock and tag the system. They disconnect some flanges and pull everything apart. And then they do some work and they put it all back together. And I asked the younger craftsperson, I said, so how are we going to put this back to work back together and why? And to be honest, the person didn't know, but the senior operator did, the senior technician. And I said, this is what's important. It's not what's on this piece of paper in this work order. What's important is the why of this work. not the what of work. The what of work is do this, do this, do this, do that. But why do we do it that way? Why do we put it back together in a different order than we took it apart? Well, it had to do with loads and spring and how things hung on the, you know, how the hangers held the pipes. And there's a variety of reasons. And this person didn't know. And I do this with electricians as well. There's a why of work for every task. And the question is, are you asking those so that your staff, the next time when you're not there, knows to think critically about the work and ask the right questions so they don't get set up to have a landmine eat their lunch in the next task? Because if we start teaching people that rote memorization or just follow the procedure, we're going to set people up for failure. And what, you know, my mind goes to what Tony was talking about. I always thought Rickover was a brilliant man. He taught us the fundamentals. And what I'm seeing many industries do is go away from that and saying, well, we can hire someone to come in and turn a wrench. Well, that makes no sense. And I think in the nuclear Navy used to say we can hire a monkey to turn a wrench or flip a switch. But we need thinking, engaged workers that are thinking before they do anything. And why are we doing it this way? So the why of work, not the water work, to me is the important aspect of this.
I think there is a testament to kind of changing how we view training and competency. Like particularly in the UK, when we deliver training, we may not say it or maybe consciously think this is why we're doing it, but most of the time I think we deliver training for compliance. We don't deliver training for competence. So our primary focus is to deliver, tick the box and say that Tony, Jim and Ron came to this course and therefore they're competent. And then we maybe give you a bit of a test, but what we don't actually do is say, does that give you the competence to be able to deal with the deviation of work and complexity of work? And that's when I try and talk to kind of customers and try and explain to them, like, when we're giving people training, it's building your adaptive capacity if you deliver it in the way that, you know, that delivers some impact and not just compliance. If you go in with the view of saying training is to build competency, that competency enables that person to make a decision in the moment to solve that problem. And I think that's a big shift for me as perspective on a lot of this stuff, as opposed to...
Let me add to that. There are industries. I've been working in one particular industry. I won't mention it by name, but I've been to like 7 or 8 of the key client or key organizations in this industry, and they hire very smart people. And their approach to training is what they call what I would call on the job training. And so if you see one, you know, if you watch somebody else do it and then you do it, then you're considered qualified. But the focus is on compliance, complying with the procedure. And these smart people, you know, they do a decent job for the most part. But when they encounter situations that are off normal, are not consistent with the procedure, typically they don't know how to respond to it because they don't know how the system is supposed to work or how it does work.
And that's interesting when you look at it like that as well, because that comes back to your point, Ron, about what we're talking about here is the gap between workers done and workers imagined. And the workforce, they solve these problems every day in spite of those procedures and those processes. They fix and they succeed every single day. And we pass. Right. Yes, there might be some maybe kind of latent issues there, but ultimately they're succeeding every single day. And the irony of all of this, which kind of makes me chuckle in a morbid way, is that you're kind of going more procedures. Let's shove the procedure. And what you don't realize is that you're actually making the problem worse because you're creating dumb clones that follow these procedures. And what you don't realize is because they're not dumb clones and they're not following the procedures, you're not having accidents. But you're trying to implement these procedures to stop accidents, and unbeknownst to you, what you're actually doing, in my opinion, is removing your capacity that happens every single day by just creating standardized clones that can't think for themselves.
We implemented this in the research community in the DOE National Lab complex, James, and We didn't use the terminology that we use in our book because some of it wasn't even created. Partly because the research community was a little bit gun-shy, having experienced some of the kind of radical Navy nuclear approaches in the Department of Energy. But we drew a box, and we said, within this box, these are the critical points. Things must go right. And don't go outside because that's unanalyzed territory. We know that there'll be some problems there. But for everything between those points in the box, we counted on expertise. Mm-hmm. We counted on the expert knowledge and abilities of our research scientists to fill in those parts. And it was counting on them to be thinkers, not just somebody following a procedure. And the approach yielded results that had great success and incident rates that were routinely much better than the operations folks that were using the more prescriptive methods for controlling work. So there was really no downside. And one of the real upsides is that those smart people that you hire and then tell what to do, they don't really appreciate that. They would like assistance, right? They would like support. They'd like that safety net that I was talking about. But they don't want you to come in and tell them how to do the job that you hired them to do. They want you to support identifying those things that absolutely must go right and how to go about doing that. But there's a whole lot of other activity outside that that you really can then leave for them. And they appreciate that.
Yeah. And we encourage managers, line managers, to get out of their office, go out into the field, actually watch work, talk to the you know, first line, front line workers, researchers, people doing the work of the organization, to understand the resource constraints, the limitations that they're working under, because like Ron had mentioned, work as done is very seldom the same as work as imagined. And primarily the reason for that gap is organizational, it's system related, and managers need to understand how their systems do or do not work to support what's going on the front line.
I love this, gents. And I think it's so interesting when you start to really pull out like tangible examples of this. And a couple of the things you're saying make me think to a kind of client that I was talking to a few months back that were dealing with like really dynamic environments. So they're dealing with high rise buildings, having to install like really heavy kind of essentially glass. So it's like high rise, high dynamic environments. And he had this really interesting approach, which I loved. Like, and when I was talking to him, he was like, I'm not sure I get all this hop stuff. And then we ended up just in a different day talking about his work and how they manage their risks. And he was telling me, oh, well, what I do, James, is first things first, we make sure we've got the majority of the team are highly competent. Like these guys are highly skilled glazers. And I was like, oh, that's awesome. Love that. You know, these guys know what they're doing. They've done this for years. And we might have one or two lower skilled people in there as labor or apprentice or something like that. But 90% of the team will always be highly skilled. So I'm like, cool. You built yourself some capacity there. I like that. And then he was like, in the van, we always try and give them the gear that we think they need to do the job, but also the gear that if they turn up and it's not quite like what we think it's going to be, like a different type of ladder or a harness or the ways to install an anchorage point and stuff like that. So he had like capacity in his tools as well and ladders and approaches to actually do the job. And then he had this really lovely little principle basically, and it was kind of, in my opinion, I'd say it was kind of like a heuristic that they created in the workforce, because he said all the lads they use this. He said, we got this thing called two changes, So we said, we'll have our risk assessment, we'll have our method statement, our procedures and our policies within the organization. But ultimately, we've got highly skilled workers. We've got enough tools to be able to deviate a little bit. And then we've got this rule called two changes. And the rule is, so when they go on site, they're allowed to deal with two changes. So if something changes and deviates from the process once, they can deal with it. Twice, they go, okay, ringing the boss, because the company have gone, that's a bit too much of a deviation from reality as to how we see it. We just want to know like what it is. We're not saying we're going to stop the work. What we're saying is two changes, ring us. So once you get to that second change, anything after that, give us a call and we'll have a chat. And I was like, you say you don't get this kind of hop stuff. You've built quite a lot of stuff in there that I really like. Like you've got highly skilled workers, you've got capacity in your tools, you've got heuristic that helps them deal with it and goes, okay, now we've gone too far and we need to ring the boss and get some help. You know, it wasn't, they didn't understand the concept of kind of point of no return, which is what I called it up until this moment. And when I kind of started explaining that, he was like, oh, I love that. We're going to implement that. That's going in as well. So he was now kind of talking with his lads, being like, right, lads, we need to highlight point of no return on our jobs and stuff like that. But I was just, people do get this. I just think sometimes it's that academic language, isn't it? And to reality. And I think what you guys do really well, and like I said, I haven't read it properly, but I have skim read the three chapters that you give away.
Let me jump on to what you're introducing, James. A lot of the organizations are doing some of the things that we talk about in the book. Yeah. And so it's important when you think, if you think as an organization, the management team, that you want to implement this, we encourage organizations to do a needs assessment. You know, where is the need? You know, what are you doing that's already, you're already doing well? You don't want to lose that. You want to keep that. But where are the gaps? Where in the operation can we do critical steps more effectively? And so that's our last chapter. The last chapter of the book is all about how do you find where we need to improve, and then how you go about implementing or executing these concepts in your organization.
Yeah. Oh. It sounded like the lorry just turned off outside, Ron. No, that's really good, gents. And I picked up in the book is those stories so far in the chapters I've read, you know, just a story, stories that I'm just reading and I'm like, wow, that's relatable. Like I can pick that up. I think one of the first examples you give is the friendly fire, is it? Is that quite early on in the book?
It's the first chapter, yeah.
Yeah, and that's really eye-opening. And I was like, such a interesting way to look at this is just more stories, the better. And I think you've hit the nail on the head with that gap between, we've got kind of like a workers done, workers imagined issue with academic safety and practical safety. I call it safety is imagined as safety is done. In like, that's what Eric and Todd, they'll talk about safety as imagined. And then the rest of us practitioners talk about safety as done. And they're not the same. Go on, Jim.
I want to make the point that in the absence of doing something, safety actually has no meaning. So
yeah.
if we're talking about what this book is about, it's about high-risk operations. Operations include safety. And I think it's important because there's a tendency these days for a lot of folks to talk about safety one, safety two, safety differently, new view safety, et cetera. But safety taken out of the context of operations really has no meaning.
Right.
So it really needs to be a conversation about doing stuff. And mm-hmm. if you consider how an expert in any field does business, when they're planning to, I use an example of when we shot a nuclear weapon with a linear accelerator. You don't just think, well, I'm going to shoot a nuclear weapon with a thing that's got a lot of energy and see what happens. You actually consider what the operating characteristics of all these pieces of equipment are, because you're a technical expert, you understand that these are potential downsides and these are the upsides that you're striving for and the balance that you're always having to make. When we talk about stuff just from the perspective of safety, it tends to skew the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think it's important not to do that.
Yeah, I always challenge managers. Whenever I have the chance to talk to executives, I ask them, what's their first priority? Invariably, they say, well, safety, you know, protecting our folks. I forgive my French, but I say, well, that's bullshit. You don't exist to be safe.
That's a lot nicer than what I'd say, Tony, if they say it to me.
You know, you exist to make a profit, or you exist to create some value that has some value in the marketplace.
Yes.
But if you cannot do that work without causing harm, you're going to be out of business eventually.
Yeah.
And so the challenge is that I have a pet peeve when I sit in on production meetings, and they always have this safety moment at the beginning. Ugh. And then they say, okay, now we spent 5 minutes on safety. Now we can talk about the real work.
Yeah.
And real work, if you think about it, is risky.
Yeah.
Work is force over a distance. And when something changes, if it doesn't change the way you want it to change, then you've caused damage or loss. And so safety, quality has to be talked about concurrent with the production process. It can't be separate.
It's an aspect of work, isn't it? Yeah.
That's what work's about. Directing that energy.
Add one thing on top of Tony and Jim's conversation, because I like where this was going, was that one of the things we talk about in the book is critical steps and risk important actions aren't things not to be done. They are baked into getting work done. We do risk important actions to produce a product, to set us up to take that critical step. I mean, if we're going to do a lifting and rigging activity, the moment you know that load gets begins to have strain on the lifting the gear, we're at a critical step. We've introduced a source of energy. Everything prior to that's risk important actions. Now you can break it down into discrete elements in the process where there's other critical steps. Don't get me wrong, but I think it's important for folks to recognize these aren't things to be avoided, but they are things to be done safely and mm-hmm. and with some precision and execution of how that is done, so that when you do that activity, we understand not only what must be done correctly, but what the outcome is going to be when we do it. Right. So I think that's an important part of this safety conversation, is that these things aren't to be avoided. Neither is safety, right? It's baked into the way we do business, but we need to understand when safety applies. And I think one of the things I heard from one of my my customers was a lot of their folks, when you use the word hazard, it's a bit nebulous, right? There's static, there's dynamic hazards, there's a variety of things. But when we talk about work, there's a hazard and a risk involved in all work that produces some sort of product or process. And what we've got to do is then pull that out. And one of the chapters in the book I think folks will appreciate is we've done a really good job of expanding what Tony worked on previously, which is critical step mapping and how to map that process out, so that when you take and you're going to bring on a new process, you can run it through this, or if you have an existing one, you can leverage this information to help you identify these risk important actions and critical steps and know where these touch points are, where you're going to have that potential for harm. And I think knowing that brings safety to the world of work. And it also brings that efficiency that Jim and Tony both expanded on.
Yeah, I was going to actually, as you were kind of talking, Ron, I was thinking, Where do you, and I realize we've been talking for a while, so we need to tie this up soon. But where do you see the concept of critical step being like actually used? Do you see that as like, it's a concept that the operator really understands so that they can identify, you know, when there's tightness in, there's load, there's, you know, energy in the load or something like that. Like, okay, now we're at a critical step. Is it in the processes, the procedures, the risk assessments, or is it both?
Well, yeah, the idea of a critical step is when you have a transfer of energy.
Yeah.
or a movement of matter from one place to another place. You're moving water from one tank to another tank, or you're heating a solution. You're adding heat and adding the temperature that solution is going up. And if that temperature rise is higher than what's allowed for that product, that substance, you may have gone past the point of no return and damaged what's in that substance. Same thing like a tire on your automobile. You know, there's a speed rating, there's a pressure rating, there's a thickness rating for a safe use of a tire. And so if you exceed any of those parameters, you know, if you're driving that car past the speed rating, God forbid, for that tire, or you let the tread go down too small, you've exceeded the critical safety parameter for that device. Yeah. And those would be considered critical steps. All right. But risk important actions, the way we think about it, create safety. We talk about the workers being able to create safety. Well, what they're creating is they're creating the safe conditions so that we can do the work without harm, without losing control. And that's done by the risk important actions. The risk important actions actually create safety. I use the example of skydiving. All right. And so the critical step, I think everybody would agree, is jumping across that open door, right? You know, jumping out of the aircraft. That's the critical step. That satisfies that definition. But what creates safety for that act? Putting on a parachute that's going to deploy properly. So it needs to be folded properly, and it has to be secured around your body. And you have to have the knowledge in order to deploy it. Yeah. And what to do if it doesn't deploy. You know, hopefully you got an emergency chute. And so there's certain conditions that have to be satisfied before the critical step, which is normal in everyday skydiving, you know, if you're a regular skydiver.
So it's kind of like how we would see it. I'm just trying to think to try to tie this in a loop for the listener if they're not quite getting it. Like, for me, it's kind of like a heuristic that we would have in our organization. It's this understanding what a critical step is. I think we would use that to help us guide our proactive work design, e.g. risk assessments, procedures, whatever. We would use it to guide that. But then also, I think we would use it in the moment with the worker to understand that they're at that point. The point of critical. So it's both, isn't it? It's, yes, it's in that work design, that admin process, but also it's in that dynamic emergent process of work as well.
Yeah. Well, talk about it from three phases: the planning, the pre-job briefing or the work discussion that's going to occur prior to the work, and then actually during work execution. And we take folks through that and we line it out very clearly how this applies to those phases of work. Mm-hmm. So that they walk away with a clear understanding what's your role relative to critical step management in these different phases of work.
Wow. I think that's awesome. I really like that.
Well, and then bringing in the realization that even though you've lined it out administratively, you think you've identified the critical steps, your folks understand the concept and they realize when you're engaging in a critical step, recognizing that because things change, that there has to be a constant vigilance. And it's driven, as Tony was talking about, by what we call chronic unease, that we need to keep evaluating, interacting with others, watching the conditions, and then seeing if the actual conditions necessary to safely perform the critical step still exist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that, gents. Right. My wife's texted me saying she's dishing up dinner. And
that's right.
Talking for over an hour. But I do want to finish on one thing. I know you finish each chapter of the book with a phrase like, what can you do tomorrow with what you've learned in this chapter? So kind of reflecting on our conversation today, what would you think that listeners can do tomorrow based on what we've been speaking about today?
But I think the simple one is to buy our book. I mean, that done.
Yeah, great. Oh, gosh. Absolutely nailed it.
Well, you know, probably the simplest thing you can do is take the definition, you know, take this definition and start looking at your work. You know, tomorrow you can start looking at your work. What activities, what human activities satisfy that definition? And then you can, then it should pop right out what you need to do in order to control that, make sure it goes right, or what you need to do to fail safely.
Yeah. Anything to add, Jim? Go on, Jim.
I'll finish up by saying that in addition, once you've got that list, start cutting. Because you undoubtedly have a lot of specification for things that are not critical.
Yeah.
And you will significantly improve the clarity of your operation.
Yeah.
And I make the distinction. You're not really trying to simplify, because in our high-risk industries, simplification can get you in trouble. Mm-hmm. But to have clarity around what must go right, and therefore those things that are not at that level of importance, will give you that bandwidth, and you'll have even more resilient operations.
Nice. Ron, anything you'd like to kind of close up with?
No, I think we've covered it, and I sure appreciate the time, James. It's been a fun and interesting journey with you. So thanks for having us on.
Thank you all for coming on. Thank you very much. We shall, where's the best place to get the book from? I assume will be Amazon.
Obviously Amazon, but actually any website that sells books should have it. But the publisher is CRC Press. It has a combined website with Routledge, and both Routledge and CRC Press are imprints of Taylor and Francis. And so if you just do a Google search on critical steps, you'll find it.
Cool. We'll get a link in the description as well, so that people can buy it, hopefully nice and easy, gentlemen. So thank you very much. Best of luck with the book sale. I know when we record this, it's coming out in a couple of days, but when this comes out, hopefully this will resurge everything. And if they haven't bought the book already, they will buy it now. But thank you very much for your time, gentlemen.
Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Thanks, James.
Okay, peeps, hope you enjoyed that chat with those three gentlemen. Hope you know more now than you did before. I hope you know now what a critical step is. I've actually been using Critical Step for a while now. I've found it a really, really good tool. Sometimes I call it point of no return, because I think people really understand that in England a little bit easier. So a little bit of practitioner experience advice there for you. That's how I've used it, and how I found a little bit more receptive of the shop floor anyway, a little bit more receptive. So hopefully you can take that away with you. Hope you enjoyed the chat. Hope you got something out of it. Just before we go, don't forget, check out rebrandsafety.com. Loads of stuff we can do for you. Consultancy, whether it's technical, whether it's cultural, loads of stuff that we can do. Project Meletium for your professional development, whether it's for you personally or for your safety team or your risk team. There's loads of offerings that we've got there, and we're currently offering a month free as well. So the code is on the website, but we'll put the code below as well, so you can get your first month free. Don't forget to check out Paradigm Human Performance if you're looking for some HOP specialist support. They are 100% the place to be if you're looking for some support. And go check out Learning Organization webinar from Paradigm as well. Thank you very much for listening. I'll catch you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only, based on limited and dated open source information, and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.